Is this mic on? It is? Never, ever get around a microphone and assume it's not on, right? Leonard Skinner died today. He was 77. We'll get to that in a second. I want to start out with... good evening, True Seekers. My name is Mike Malloy. Thanks for tuning in. It's 7 past the hour. Prairie 2 got this in. Let's see, the time signature, 8:58:23 p.m. today, 8:58, 9 minutes ago. Way to go, Bruce. Here's what he said. Here's Prairie 2's economic affairs correspondence report for today. In case you weren't having fun yet, you'll be glad to know the longest recession since the last time the Republicans broke the economy in 1929 ended more than a year ago. Yeah, I heard that today. I thought, what in the hell? Prairie 2 says it lasted just 18 months, two more than the Reagan recession, but we're out of the official recession, mostly on strength of a stock market propped up by Wall Street banks who in turn have been using free Federal Reserve money to fund their very profitable trading divisions. And by the way, those profits are coming out of your retirement accounts. So it will look like everybody's making money until the next flash crash. Then only Wall Street will have the money. To give Obama credit, keeping the auto industry from going the way of the U.S. steel, textile, electronics, appliances, you know, the list goes on, keeping autos from going extinct like those industries did help. That and his stimulus measures did give the economy a branch to grab, but we're still hanging over the bottomless gorge. Today we have 4 million Americans added to the poverty rolls and another 3 million avoiding poverty only on the strength extended extended unemployment benefits, and a record 49 million Americans living in multi-generational homes to make ends meet, with 44% of that number that would be in poverty if measured as sub-family units. A sub-family unit is like grandparents as a unit. Each child with their children is a unit. The 30-something guy listening to the radio while polishing his gun counts as a unit, and so on, so on, so on. We now have 14% of adults, 25 to 34, living with their parents. And as single individuals, their poverty rate would be 43%. That means 57% make more than $10,830 a year, but likely not much more. Minimum wage for full-time workers at $7.25 an hour is slightly more than $14,000 in a year, if you can find the work. Interestingly, the 25 cents an hour minimum wage established in 1938, if you factor in inflation, would translate today to between $12 and $14 an hour. So instead of 44 million Americans in poverty, the real number is more like 70 million. You can say these people are getting by, so they really aren't poor. Just like tens of millions more who make enough to not be classified as poor at the arbitrary cutoff point. So you have a real big chunk of the country living in poverty or in conditions that aren't that much better. The right winger says, I'll let them pull themselves up by the bootstraps, get a job. A job? Perhaps in the steel industry or electronics or textiles or appliance manufacturing. Or they could go into the small business the family has owned for generations. Oh, wait, there's a Walmart in town now. We won't even talk about the family farm. How about a good union job down at the slaughterhouse? That's a place to start. Your chances there aren't that much better than the animals waiting in the yard. No, the recession hasn't ended anywhere but on paper. The stimulus money is working through the system, but eventually it just drains away to China. The unemployment extension is already running out, and those millions have already used up their savings, their assets. If they are lucky, they can join a multifamily household, along with 1.5 million young adults that come of age every year and find no work in the jobless recovery. But don't worry! The Republicans have all the answers. They say they'll just do more of what they did when they were in charge before. after November. And that worked out so well, didn't it? PrairieNumeral2.com, our economic affairs correspondent. Leonard Skinner died in his sleep early this morning. He was 77. Leonard Skinner. His son, also named Leonard Skinner, said his father had a bowl of ice cream just past midnight. He loved ice cream. And then was found dead around 2:30 a.m. Isn't that what happened to, was it Jefferson? Thomas Jefferson? Or was it, yeah, I think it was Thomas Jefferson. He had a big bowl of ice cream from the, cold cream or something that he put on some fruit. And then he died of a short, oh well. I don't know why that popped into my head. Useless information. He had been a resident at St. Catherine Labor Manor, a nursing home in Riverside, Florida, for a year. He had Alzheimer's. Mr. Skinner never asked to become part of rock and roll lore. He didn't even like rock and roll. He was just a by-the-book PE teacher at Robert E. Lee High School, his alma mater, who in the late 60s sent some students to the principal's office because their hair was too long. Gene Odom, who worked security for the band and survived the plane crash in 1977, said one of the long hairs was Gary Rossington. Rossington was a guitarist in a rock band that would later name itself Leonard Skinnerd in a smart alecky tribute to the gym teacher. During an interview in January 2009, Mr. Skinner said he was just following the rules about hair length. It always bothered him that the legend grew to say he was particularly tough on the boys, or that he'd kick them out of school. He said, quote, it wasn't against the school rules. I don't particularly like long hair on men. Or it was against school rules. I don't particularly like long hair on men, but again, it wasn't my rule. What? I hear you out there. You're saying, what the hell is he talking about Leonard Skinner for? You've heard, I'm sure you've been on YouTube, or even Bob Schieffer played it on CBS Face the Nation yesterday, a little clip of Christine O'Donnell, the teabag candidate for governor in Delaware. Apparently, there are all sorts of VHS-era video clips of this woman. And you also know, I'm sure, Bill Maher, the liberal host of HBO's Real Time, told his audience the other night that Christine O'Donnell had been a guest 22 times on his old ABC series Politically Incorrect in the 90s, and that he still has all the tapes. He said, Bill Maher said that if Ms. O'Donnell refuses to appear on Real Time, he's going to show a clip every week. He said, quote, it's like a hostage crisis. Every week you don't show up, I'll throw a body out. End quote. All right, when we come back, I'll play that for you. You know, I have to do this. I have to do this stuff because if we just do the stuff that makes you sick and me sick, then we'll just go crazy, right? So I know what I'm doing, playing this stupid clip. And then I have one of Bill Maher talking about Sarah Palin and Larry King. We had to bleep out the N-word, but I want you to hear both of these. We'll do it when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. By the way, what's today, the 20th? On Thursday, the first round of the new improved health care rules kick in, and complain as we want to, and I think the program, or what was passed by the Congress, really sucked because it was a golden opportunity to provide single payer, or at least Medicare for everybody. But aside from my bitching and complaining, as of this Thursday, all kids now can get coverage, no matter if they have pre-existing conditions. This is going to be just a hell of a break for an awful lot of families. There'll be no lifetime limits on how much your policy has to pay, which also will be a break for people with chronic diseases that may require surgeries. Kids can stay on your policy until they're 26, and you cannot be denied because of pre-existing conditions. So we can bitch and moan and complain and say what we want, but come Thursday, those rules kick in. All right, you want to hear what Christine O'Donnell said? This is from Politically Incorrect about 10 years ago. Here she is. She's coming in a second. Okay, let's do Mara second. Let's do Christine O'Donnell. No, I don't want Leonard Skinner. We going to have her or what?
You were a witch.
I dabbled into witchcraft.
Why don't you start it over again?
Okay. You were a witch.
I dabbled into witchcraft. I never joined a coven.
Wait a minute, you were a witch?
Yeah, she was
I was a witch. That's exactly why.
How are you a witch?
Because I dabbled into witchcraft. I hung around people who were doing these things.
Having fun?
I'm not making this stuff up. I know what they told me they do.
Well, what did they do?
One of my first dates with the witch was on a satanic altar, and I didn't know it. And, I mean, there's little blood and stuff like that.
That was a date? Your first date was a satanic altar?
Yeah, we went to a movie and then, like, had a little midnight picnic.
Let's have a movie and a sacrifice?
Oh, God, in the first place, witches or Wiccans have nothing to do with satanic altars. Oh, my God. But you hear her voice. That is the Republican senatorial candidate from the state of Delaware. All right, Bill Maher, speaking of Maher, that was from his old program, Politically Incorrect, and it was politically incorrect enough that ABC fired him. And now, of course, he's on HBO. Here's Bill Maher. He went on, he was with Larry King the other night. This is Bill Maher on a little bit on, I think he mentions Christine O'Donnell, right? But he talks about, he doesn't talk about her at all. This is about Sarah Palin. Here we go.
I think she's going to run for president. For one.
Could win if there's enough candidates.
Well, I don't know about that.
To win the nomination.
I cannot wait to see the Republican debates in 2012. When you think about who is going to be on that panel, Sarah Palin, Newt Gingrich, Haley Barbour, John Bolton, Tim Pawlenty, Mitt Romney, how are they going to out-fire breathe each other? I mean, where this rhetoric has gone to at this point, it's only 2010. And we're having Newt Gingrich, as we were talking about before, calling him an anti-colonial Lao tribesman. Lao tribesman, that's the new Kenyan, Larry. And Kenyan, of course, was code for... But that's where they are. They can't say it out loud, but that's where this whole campaign is going to be. You asked about racism, it's all about racism. They cannot fathom this idea that there is a black president, and that's what they are going to fight about. The other thing about Sarah Palin is that if you read that Vanity Fair article this month, if you read the Newsweek cover story a few months ago where she was praying on the cover, she's a true religious nut. I know people are saying, oh, there goes Bill Maher, he's always talking about religion. Well, read the article, read about her. There's a part where it says they were giving her books to study up on, and they came back and said, did you read any? And she said, no, I haven't looked at the books. I'm just reading the emails from my prayer warriors. Prayer warriors. These are people, and she's one of them, who believe there are demons in the world. Everything in her worldview is about demons or angels, people who are with us and people who are against us. You know, when liberals say things like, well, when you fight the mosque, building the mosque in New York, you're just encouraging a war with Islam. They don't understand. People like Sarah Palin want a war with Islam. That's what it says in the Bible. Bring it on. Let's get it over with.
Yeah, I can't think of a single Republican candidate or would-be candidate for any office anywhere in the United States, from the very top to the very bottom, who is not a religious fanatic, a Christian religious fanatic, who, as Mara points out about Palin, believes in this struggle between darkness and light, demons and angels, Satan and God, or Barack Obama and the low tribesmen of Kenya. It's madness. We'll be back momentarily. Stay with us. I'm Mike Mullay.
Microphone, and that makes him dangerous.
25.
It's Mike Mullay.
Oh, thank you. 25 before the hour. Just one more thing tonight on this crazy woman from Delaware. A spokesperson for the neo-pagan network, The Witch's Voice, sent in a comment to Huffington Post. Sam Stein, writing at Huffington Post, covered the story a little bit. The spokesman for the Neo-Pagan Network said, quote, "I really have to question what she's talking about," referring to Christine O'Donnell's comments, "because witchcraft and Satanism are two different things. Witches or Wiccans do not believe in Satan. We don't even believe that Satan exists. Satan is a Christian deity of some kind. He is part of the Christian religion, not ours. We worship nature. We work very closely with nature. We do not have blood on our altar, and we have nothing to do with Satan. So I don't know what Ms. O'Donnell is talking about. I wonder if she knows what she's talking about." Well, as Kathy pointed out in her blog today at Kathy's Diary at MikeMullay.com, for some odd reason, it seems like the two leading lights in the female section of the teabagger publicity crap are both concerned about witches and demons and spooks and things that go bump in the night. Folks, this is your Republican Party. I mean, this is your Republican Party. And, of course, capitalist America, the corporatists are looking at all this, and they're just going, yeah, you people keep it up. Just keep, that's right. Just keep talking about witches and exorcisms and demons and blood on the altar and all this other horse crap while we continue to take everything that's not nailed down. And then we'll come for that, and then we'll come for the nails. So, whatever. Now, a minute ago, I mentioned that as of Thursday, health insurance for children cannot be denied, no pre-existing conditions where it gets policy. We had an interesting thing happen the other day. Kathy did. We need to make some changes in our insurance coverage. And we're thinking about getting a standalone policy for Molly. She's 6 years old, never been sick, has all her immunization records up to date, healthy kid. I swear to God, she does not get sick. So Kathy went around to all the leading insurers' websites, and she spent, you know, a couple hours, and I said, you know, I came drifting through where she was working. I said, "What have you found?" She said, "You're not going to believe this. Insurance companies are not selling policies on children anymore." I said, "What?" Well, here's the story. This is from The Hill. Health plans in at least four states have announced they're dropping children's coverage just days ahead of new rules created by the health care reform law. The new health care law forbids insurers from turning down children with pre-existing conditions starting Thursday. But news of insurers dropping their plans as a result of the new law has thrown a damper on the strategy of the Democrats highlighting this. You see how this works? You see how this filthy son of a bitch and capitalist pig bastard, I'm sorry, insurance companies work? Huh? You see? You see how this works? The announcement could lead to higher costs for some parents who are buying separate coverage for themselves and their children at lower costs than the family's coverage that's available to them. Now, that's not necessarily the situation we have to deal with, but because of some weird rules with the AFTRA union, we're thinking about putting Molly on a separate coverage, a separate policy. But all of a sudden, it looks like it can't be done. The a spokesman for the Healthcare for America Now, which is a grassroots, legitimate grassroots progressive group, said, "We're just days away from a new era when insurance companies must stop denying coverage to kids just because they're sick. And now some of the biggest insurance companies decide to refuse to sell child-only coverage. The latest announcement by the insurance companies that they won't cover kids is immoral, and to blame their appalling behavior on the new law is patently dishonest. Instead, they should reverse their actions immediately and simply follow the law. If the insurance companies can casually turn their backs on sick children now, who will they abandon next? This offensive behavior by the insurance companies is yet another reminder of why the new law is so important and why the Republicans' call for repeal is so misguided." It's every day I'm alive, every day I'm alive, I get stunned by, and I shouldn't, because I should be cynical enough at this point in my life and not let this stuff surprise me. But I am stunned every single day of my life recently here. There hasn't been a day go by when these filthy Republican capitalist whores, no offense to real sex workers, do something that shows their contempt and disgust for children, for workers, for the middle class, for the working class, and yet people are going to vote for them. And some of you wonder why I talk about the butt level of stupidity, willful stupidity in this country. I get emails from people who say, "Well, you arrogant son of a bitch. What makes you think you're so smart?" I'm not smart. Never said I was. Never. Matter of fact, I claim just the opposite. I wish you were smarter. But how intelligent do you have to be to watch without comment while Republicans and conservatives continue to destroy the country, you know, without saying anything? I mean, and in the process, destroying their own lives. How long must one watch that before you just have to comment on it? I don't care if you have a radio program or not. But the Limbaugh filth in this country and the Hannity filth and the Beck filth are now putting out the story that it's Obama's law, you see, Obamacare, that is causing children to be thrown off the insurance rolls. And you know how many hundreds of thousands of millions of stupid, dumbass Americans are going to believe that? Well, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. When the lights go out, I know exactly who I want to meet up with. Joe Miller, this is from Carol Lee at Crooks and Liars again. Yeah, bless her heart. Joe Miller makes Sharon Angle, that's that freak out in Nevada who's running against Harry Reid, look liberal and sane. Joe Miller makes Sharon Angle look sane. Joe Miller, possible Republican nominee for the Senate. What do you mean possible? He beat Murkowski. Teabagger. Among Miller's views, he wants to eliminate the Department of Education. He believes the government shouldn't pay for unemployment insurance. He says it's unconstitutional. Oh, gee, Joe, really? He says of climate change on his campaign site that it may not even exist. He would end welfare. He would eliminate health care for the poor by scrapping Medicaid. And the Anchorage Daily News reported that he has called for sweeping cuts to Medicare and Social Security with the goal of phasing them out entirely in favor of total privatization. This is a teabagger's dream right there. The teabaggers, don't forget, they're nothing more than the storm, the shock troops, the streetwalkers for capitalist corporate America. I'm just curious. I don't know how many people are on Medicare or Social Security or have to qualify for Medicaid in the state of Alaska. But this is what I was just talking about. These people are going to vote for this halfwit. They're going to vote for this Joe Miller. A lot of them already did. I wonder if they were clear on his positions. Joe Miller is a typical teabag candidate. Again, nothing but a front person for capitalist America that wants to destroy utterly and once and for all and forever the viability of a middle class in this country. Because the middle class causes you problems. The lower economic rungs on the ladder never cause trouble because they're too busy trying to figure out a way to find their next meal. It's that goddamn middle class in country after country after country, era after era, society after society. It's that filthy middle class that when they've had enough, they rise up. And they rise up with guns. And they say to the oppressor, the real oppressor, not this straw man, but the real oppressor, which is usually the royalty in a different era, the clergy in another era, the capitalists in several eras. When they rise up with their weapons and they say, "You have destroyed us long enough. We've had enough. We've watched enough of our children die, and our parents die, and our grandparents wind up in the dirt somewhere, and we're not taking it anymore." And then you hear the tumbrils turn, and out comes the guillotine. That's going to happen again. That's going to happen again. It's going to happen in this country if this doesn't stop.
Truth seekers, gather round the campfire. It's more Mike Malloy.
He went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul, cause I think I'm better than you." The boy said, "My name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet you're gonna regret, cause I'm the best as ever been. Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, cause hell's broke loose in Georgia and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul."
I like that song. Too bad Charlie Daniels is such a right-wing freak. Is that all you have for that? That's it? I like that part where he says, "I told you once, you son of a bitch." Gordon, Oklahoma City. Mike, O'Donnell and the teabaggers illustrate what the Republican Party has morphed into, a dangerous religious cult with sleeper cells in every community. We've been warned about this sort of thing for years. Paddle faster, my friend. I hear banjos. A dangerous religious cult with sleeper cells. That is so true. From our education affairs correspondent, Kate Petrini in San Francisco. Hi, Mike. Today's lesson from a U.S. government student started with having them work in groups to brainstorm the issues they are most concerned about. Their lists included the following items: education, especially higher education, health care, future employment prospects, the recession, civil and gay rights, reliable public transportation, housing costs. There were 8 groups of 3 students, and almost each list had the above items in common. The similarities were not surprising, considering that these kids are all seniors in high school who will be starting college next fall. What struck me was not what was on the list, but what was left off. That's right. Not one student mentioned the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Not one. Yet these are kids in the age group that is always affected by a government's military escapades. So why didn't the word war appear on anyone's radar screen this morning? Could it be because the American media have lost interest in the topic now that the mission accomplished banner takes up space in a landfill and the criminals who started these invasions have retired to their estates in Texas and Wyoming? Or could it be that because these travesties continue to affect only a small and for the most part impoverished section of this country, Iraq and Afghanistan no longer exist for the rest of us? Over the weekend, I listened to a couple of your archive shows from September of 2003. Back then, the corporate media and the right wing, but I repeat myself, were jubilant, cheering George W. Bush and labeling anyone who disagreed with the invasion of Iraq as unpatriotic or even a terrorist. They celebrated as the Bush crime family sent thousands of young men and women off to die or to return physically and mentally scarred for life. Today, they can't be bothered with any of it. And with very few exceptions, neither can we. It's outrageous that the citizens of this country and their elected representatives have done nothing to hold the Bush crime family accountable for taking this country to war based on lies. Even worse, a mere 7 years later, no one seems to remember or give a damn about any of it. Kay. Her website is kaysreportcard.com. kaysreportcard.com. Yeah, that is. I think that's the thing that pushed Bob Alexander over the edge. I know it certainly has pushed me up to the edge. I don't flip over like some folks have. You know what I'm talking about? Because I've got to do this job every night. Oh, I choose to do it every night. I don't have to do it, but I choose to do it. And I've got to retain at least a tiny bit, just a shred of coherence. But that's the same issue that almost has pushed me over the edge. When it has become a matter of fact, of simple fact, that we had a regime in this country in charge for 8 years that not only destroyed the economy, not only legitimized torture, not only legitimized the kidnapping and renditioning of people to other countries to be tortured, but also involved this country in 2 illegal wars, one of which didn't even have a shred of reality about it. That one was based on lies, deception, untruths, half-truths, collaboration by at the highest level of government, and nobody is doing a thing. Nothing. Former prosecutor from L.A., Bugliosi. What's his first name? I forgot already. Vincent, yeah. Vince Bugliosi and his book and Bob Alexander's efforts at getting that book in the hands of every county prosecutor in the United States who was the prosecutor of a county where a young man or young woman died as a result of Bush's lies to put this miserable bastard George Bush on trial for murder. One person responded, and then she was defeated. I think she was defeated. She was running for prosecutor. Nothing nothing is being done. Nothing ever will be done. Now, to the rest of the world, that speaks volumes. Historically, we all say, gee, how did the Germans let that happen? How did the Germans let that happen back in the 30s? How did that happen? And eventually, at some point in history, the same question is going to be asked about us. How did the American people let that happen? We'll be back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Next hour, we have a couple of things here that the current and not so current story. The current story kind of broke a couple of weeks ago, and several people sent me links to the story about U.S. soldiers deciding to commit murder in Afghanistan for the sport of it. And then, I hate to do a topic like this, I really do, but we're going to do this next hour. Killing Afghan civilians for sport and then taking souvenirs like skulls, fingers, hands. And how that relates to a novel that I read, as a teenager, I guess. That's coming up next hour. If you've been following the saga of Christopher Hitchens, you know that he is getting close to the end of his life because of the cancer of the esophagus. He is he's on a tour. you got to love him, right? The way the Associated Press reports, is stricken the cancer and fragile from chemotherapy, author and outspoken atheist Christopher Hitchens sits in an armchair before an audience and waits for the only question that can come first at such a time. How's your health? Hitchens is there to be part of a debate in front of a group dedicated to defending Christianity in Alabama. Hitchens' answer, quote, well, I'm dying, since you asked, but so are you. I'm only doing it more rapidly. Hitchens, his voice is weak and raspy. Only wisps of dark hair remain. Clothes hang on his frame. Remember, he wrote the book in 2007, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. He has esophageal cancer, same disease that killed his father. He's 62, and he says at the very best, his life will be shortened dramatically. For some of his critics, it might be satisfying to see a man who has made a career of skewing organized religion switch sides near the end of his life and pray silently for help fighting a ravaging disease. But Hitchin says no. He has an opportunity. Monday, I think it's Monday coming. Maybe it's next Monday, or this Monday, which is almost over. But I think next Monday. Monday has been informally proclaimed, everybody pray for Hitchin's Day. He said, I shall not be participating. So, anyway. I find it interesting. I always have. That so many people, so many Christian people, see disease or accidents or human tragedy as a result of something in God's great plan. There was a terrible accident in, upstate New York. 8 people in a church van. There were about 14 people crammed into this van, and the van blew a left rear tire. The van rolled a couple of times. People were tossed out on the road. I think 8 people died. 6 or 8 people died. All members of this religious group, a church group out of New York City, I think. And the other members of the community, the religious community, are saying, well, God must have had a reason to take them. And anytime I hear that, I don't know. Is that how you cope with death? It's not how I would cope with death. It's certainly not how we're explaining to Molly, our 6-year-old, about death, that it's some act of a mysterious sky being who can push buttons and, you know, tsunamis appear or earthquakes or car wrecks or esophageal cancer. I just don't know how people can live a life where they believe that they're totally at the mercy and the whim of some capricious freak who lives up in the clouds who decides, well, I think I'll kill those babies today. Well, I think I'll wipe out 200,000 people in Indonesia just for the, because I can. Let me see what I'm new to today. I know. I'll take 6 million of my chosen people and have them all executed. Gassed. And I'm going to pick my good friend Adolf to do this. You know, this is. Never mind. Never mind my ass. It just blows me away that people can do that. I mean, to me, that has nothing to do with spirituality. You know what has to do with spirituality if you really want to get down to it? Wicca. It does. Or nothing. It doesn't have to be Wicca. Just sit down and clear your mind. Do what, Harvey Cox, theologian, talked about. Was it Harvey Cox or was it Ram Dass? Richard Alpert, I forget. Somebody will send me an email and tell me. Who said one of the most interesting exercises that a human being can do while he or she is still alive is to sit quietly and contemplate the deep darkness right behind your eyes. The infinite deep darkness right behind your eyes. Was that Harvey Cox? Oh, well. Montana Republican Party wants to make homosexuality illegal. And then they're going to go after Judaism. They're going to make that illegal. And then they're going to make being left-handed illegal. The party adopted an official platform a couple of months ago that keeps a long-held position in support of making homosexuality illegal, a policy adopted after the Montana Supreme Court struck down such laws in 1997. And as the AP reports, the fact that it's still the official party policy more than 12 years later, despite a tidal shift in public attitude since then. And the party's own pledge of support for individual freedoms has made some Republicans exasperated. State Senator Joe Brueggemann, Republican of Polson, Montana, said last week, quote, I looked at that and said, you got to be kidding me. Should it get taken out? Absolutely. Does anybody think we should be arresting homosexual people? If you take that stand, you really probably shouldn't be in the Republican Party, end quote. What are you talking about, John? What do you mean you shouldn't be in the Republican Party? Your party, pal, in case you haven't noticed, is now a wholly owned subsidiary. Wholly, H-O-L-Y. A wholly owned subsidiary of right-wing, snake-handling, gibbering, Satans and demons and angels Christianity, pal. You are the one who shouldn't be in the Republican Party if you think that the stance against homosexuals is as insane as it really is. Of course it's insane. But your party is insane. So, Joe Brueggemann, maybe you ought to leave the Republican Party. What do you think? Curious, as was the editorial writer at the New York Times the other day, about new legislation to protect people who work in the extracting industries, whether it's coal mining or deep sea oil drilling. You'd think taxpayers have a right to expect passage, the Times says, of a life and death measure to protect the nation's coal miners. Nothing's being done thanks to the Republicans. There is a bill that has worked is working its way through the House. The case for stronger safety laws was tragically made last April when 29 miners were killed in an explosion in the upper Big Branch mine in West Virginia. The shoddy, almost non-existent safety record of the mine owner, Massey Energy, soon became clear. And Senator Rockefeller of West Virginia has tried to put together a bipartisan bill to put some teeth into mine safety regulations and also mine inspections. Of course, the mining industry is arguing against it, and the pieces of human waste that call themselves Republican senators are also refusing to go along with this. I mean, it's one thing to say that you hate Barack Obama and to cover your ass and not admit that you hate him because he's a African-American. That's one thing. You know, you can't wait until the Negro gets out of the White House. But isn't it kind of just contemptible to be a Republican legislator and refuse to vote in favor of providing the Mine Safety and Health Administration with subpoena power for owners who will not pay attention to the regulations. They just don't care. During 8 years of Reagan-Bush, during 8 years of Cheney-Bush, mine owners, oil companies are told, go ahead, just do whatever you want to do. Look at all the people that have died. Oil extraction, coal mining. But the Republicans are saying no. Why would anybody vote for a Republican for anything? You right-wingers, I don't know if I should open the phones tonight or not. I'm really not in the mood for it. But I think about you slimy, disgusting conservatives, you Republicans. Yeah, I know, driving around out there listening to Sirius and XM. You know, what a bunch of bastards you really are. You really are. To be part of a party that would want to, from one extreme, arrest people because they happen to be gay, to the other extreme, to actively refuse to provide legislation that would make it a little easier to make sure that mine owners are operating as safely as possible for the people that go underground, so that you lard-ass Republicans can run your air conditioners starting in February, if you want to, run your heat, your computers, your whatever it is that you do. You bastards. You really are. Because it's not Democrats who are holding it up. It's not even Democrats from the states where mining is a big deal. It's Republicans. And see, again, this is how capitalism works. Regulations that might require a mine owner, a corporation that owns a mine, legislation that might require them to provide safe working conditions, as safe as possible. I'd like to see one of these lard-ass Republicans go, 3,000 feet below the surface of the earth and start digging out pieces of black rock. Go ahead. That's like Rush Limbaugh trying to get, telling everybody, well, I didn't go in the military because I had a problem with my ass, aside from the fact it was too big. But this is one of the reasons that capitalism is a pro-death economic system. I mean, how would you identify? What would you say, Mr. and Ms. Right-Winger? What would you say, Mr. and Ms. Republican? Huh? Your party says, now we that's intrusive government policy. That's the Kenyan in the White House. Now he's trying to take over the mine industry. I don't get you people. It's one thing to call him a Kenyan. It's something else again. What about all the white miners who go into these coal mines? I mean, obviously you people think that a white life is worth more than a black life. Okay. But overarching everything in your disgusting lives is your fealty to capitalism, even though capitalism is cutting your throat. I wonder if you right-wingers will ever get that. Nah. We'll be right back. I I want to share with you an email I got from Joy in Santa Fe the other day. Kind of been holding on to it. And I think, you know, for no apparent reason, but I think I'll share it with you right now. And don't forget, coming up next hour, we take a look at a really nasty, nasty, nasty topic. Hello, Mike and Kathy. In listening to and observing conservative and Tea Party followers' messages, whether on TV programs with disingenuous talking points sharply aimed at the listeners, or in messages displayed on signs filmed at events, the consistent demand is, get government off my back, and we want a smaller government. Why is it then that the conservatives and the Teabag Party followers choose to interfere in the most personal of issues in individuals' lives? Their kind of government and oversight is not the humanitarian and socially responsible governing that assures, for example, that elders have an income in later life provided through their own and their employer's investment in Social Security insurance, or that worker safety and workers' rights are protected and their livelihoods maintained through labor representation or employment insurance. No, none of that. They choose to intrude into the most personal areas of citizens' lives, the areas of sexuality, marriage, reproduction, and end-of-life decisions. After insisting that they want a smaller government and more individual freedoms, the conservatives, including Palin, Beck, Engel, and now O'Donnell, are unable to see anything contradictory in their need to control the most intimate and important decisions individuals make in their lives, such as marriage in the gay and lesbian community, adoption of children by gay parents, reproductive rights of women. This is outrageously evidenced in the Conservative Party's relentless efforts toward having the right congressional and Supreme Court membership to reverse Roe v. Wade. However, this is a very time-limited, intrusive commitment from their base to the child and parent or parents, as no assistance through social policies would ever be legislated to support parents in situations where poverty was the underlying concern in seeking an abortion. That said, each situation informing a woman to seek abortion is not an area for government interference. The case of Terry and Michael Schiavo that lasted approximately 6 years in various bizarre dimensions was invaded by the conservatives, among them Jeb Bush, who ordered the feeding tube reinserted, and later George Bush, who flew to D.C. to sign a bill authorizing that federal courts had jurisdiction over this case. Both actions are outrageous examples of government interference in a citizen's private business. My husband is a respiratory therapist in an ICU where critical care involves extubating patients on ventilator life support, as he did last evening, based on the family's decision regarding end-of-life care and or more favorably when possible through advanced directives, such as a living will, which acts as a legal contract when the individual can no longer express his or her wishes during end-of-life critical situations. No government officials are needed to express their opinions or to interfere with decisions made by individuals or family members, such as those that Terry and Michael Schiavo had shared as spouses. Yet the conservatives in the Bush years injected themselves into this matter and created a media storm out of what should have been maintained and resolved only as a private matter. I would like to hear you or your listeners discuss any contradictions such as these regarding the conservative and Tea Party fringe shouting government off our backs, except when it involves their moralizing or attaching demands to what should be their own private ethical and moral worldview. Not one forced on millions of people, regardless of an individual's religious beliefs or aesthetic or agnostic beliefs, or atheistic or agnostic beliefs. More and more in this insane environmental shift from a government of women and men of diverse belief systems, we are moving toward the conservatives' footprint as a country comprised of leadership that is God-fearing, moralizing, bigoted, misinformed, ethnocentric, homophobic, militaristic, and so completely ignorant. These are the only people found who can serve or are willing to represent cities and states among millions. The most ignorant, dreary, and obsolete thinkers or non-thinkers and their following who are incapable of critical thinking, equal to their inability to recognize when they are being duped, exploited, and misinformed, brings a depressing daily reminder of how damaged and at risk of further crisis beyond financial viability await us as the deterioration of our political system worsens. Without using the cry, "This is not my America," whatever the hell kind of America we were and could be and should be, we have always denied and excused and minimized our mistakes, atrocities, and shortcomings. However, the direction which we are moving now is certainly a direction we must resist, and one which you nightly renounce for its inhumanity and greedy love of the dollar over compassion and justice and leadership that includes concern for the viability of every American. I would like to hear progressives on any program, Rachel Maddow show perhaps, address the conservatives' contradictory small government stand and know why they will be confronted on the audacity of their self-absorbed priorities. And know that they will, I should say, be confronted on the audacity of their self-absorbed priorities, which they are forcibly inserting into the political discourse. I know that you do not rightly decide. I know that you do not rightly decide to invite political figures onto your show. So among your listeners, when you have the programming time, it would be beneficial to hear what others think of this glaring inconsistency and why government off my back has so many exceptions in the right-wing manifesto. How do we expose these duplicitous individuals when our press is lazy and ineffective in that role? Joy in Santa Fe. How do we expose? Well, we tell each other about it, but as far, I think what you mean, Joy, is how do we expose it on a national level? I don't think we do. I don't think we do. Willful ignorance is almost indefeatable or undefeatable. And willful ignorance is what every single Republican, right-wing Christian Republican is involved in, willful ignorance. You know, the truth of so many things are staring these people right into their eyes, whether it's an issue of economic reality, spiritual reality, militaristic reality, whatever the reality is, staring them right in the face. Telling them this reality tells these right-wingers and a lot of now brain-dead or shell-shocked Democrats what to do. You have to resist. You've got to resist. And they don't. The teabag movement, oh, they're willing to resist. But they want to resist the continuation of their own lives, right? Isn't that what they're saying? We don't want health care. We don't want health and safety rules. We don't want any checks and balances on predatory capitalism. We want to eat rotten meat and germ-infested food products. We do, we really do, because the alternative is to let the government run by that Kenyan make all these decisions. We want poison in our water. We want filth in our air. Isn't that what they're saying? Isn't that what is being said every time these Republicans do what capitalist America tells them to do and says, oh no, let's take to the streets. We don't want no regulation. We don't want no mine safety. That'll interfere with profit. So Joy, you know, your letter is very articulate and well thought out. I honestly believe that short of some a messianic character, and I don't mean in a religious sense, who political character, and I thought it was going to be Obama, short of the appearance of that man or that woman who can inspire people to open their eyes and drop the willful ignorance. Short of that, I think the only thing that is going to get everybody's attention is blood in the streets. I really do. I don't like that because it might be my blood, but what are you going to do? What does it take to wake people up? So, anyway, thanks for writing, Joy.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming. Was the loser now will be later to win. For the times, they are a-changing.
I had a hammer in the morning, a hammer in the evening.
For the hour. Pacific Gas and Electric, the ones responsible for the explosion and destruction of 100 homes in San Bruno, the death of five people. This was in the Mercury News, San Jose. It says, even though state officials awarded PG&E nearly $5 million in ratepayer money in 2007 to replace a South San Francisco natural gas line identified as a high safety risk, the utility never did the work. And now PG&E is seeking another $5 million to make the repairs. That's according to a consumer group, the Utility Reform Network. The accusation comes as the San Bruno catastrophe is generating a wave of legislative proposals to reduce the chances of such a disaster happening again. The allegations from the Utility Reform Network center on a section of pipe north of the gas line that exploded in San Bruno. The South San Francisco section is on a list of 100 portions of pipe that PG&E has declared a high risk. The Utility Reform Network added that the California Public Utilities Commission granted the company $5 million from ratepayers 3 years ago, assuming PG&E would replace the pipe in 2009, but it wasn't done. The Utility Reform Network said that work wasn't done and that PG&E had recently submitted a list of construction projects for which it wants the state agency to pay. See, Pacific Gas and Electric, capitalist enterprise, regulated apparently, I'm not familiar with how it works in California, but to some degree regulated by the state. So why doesn't Pacific Gas and Electric, why don't they take their own profit and do the, don't laugh, corporate responsible thing? I said don't laugh. and fix the goddamn pipe themselves. The ratepayers don't make a profit. The ratepayers pay. And pay, and pay, and pay, because I'm sure PG&E is no different from the Southern Company or Georgia Power. So here we go again, you see. Socialize the cost, privatize the profit. In PG&E's request for more funding, which is pending the commission's approval, the utility is now seeking to begin the work on the pipe in 2012. The company's documents, which the Utility Reform Network made public, indicate the utility still thinks the section is in dangerous shape, calling the risk of failure on the pipe, quote, unacceptably high, end quote. One PG&E document noted in an apparent reference to a possible explosion that, quote, it has a potential impact radius of 415 feet and is located in a heavily urbanized area, end quote. The Utility Reform Network senior attorney Mike Florio said, quote, not only are they bilking the ratepayers, but they are endangering public safety. I think it's fair to ask, if they had done the work, maybe they could have found something that might have alerted them to the potential of a catastrophic failure of the San Bruno pipe, end quote. So, I just wonder, once again, to me, and I don't know how Pacific Gas and Electric is set up. I think Pacific Gas and Electric was one of the companies that screwed the ratepayers in California when Enron was operating. Wasn't that? Wasn't it Pacific Gas and Electric? If it wasn't, I'll just say excuse me before PG&E sends me a letter threatening a lawsuit. Screw you people. I mean, seriously. But wasn't it PG&E that worked very closely with Enron? You remember Enron, don't you? Huh? Enron? What's Enron, Mike? Wasn't it to consciously and deliberately gouge ratepayers in California for electricity? Remember that? That seems so long ago, doesn't it? Wasn't that a long time ago? What was that? 5, 6, 7 years ago? Huh? Who was the head of Enron? Remember Ken Lay and Skilling? Wasn't there a guy named Skilling? Tom Skilling? No, he's the weatherman. It was his brother, the weatherman on Channel 9 in Chicago. Remember Ken Lay and Enron and Pacific Gas and Electric? Wasn't it Pacific Gas? I don't know. So PG&E says, hey, listen, we need to make some repairs. Give us some money. And when they have their big profit-sharing party sometime later this year, I'm sure they'll be handing out money too, right? All right, stick around. What we have coming up is something real scary and real macabre and real gruesome. In other words, something you're really going to love. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. the hour. You're hearing things, aren't you? You thought you heard that music twice. It's this little witchcraft cast this way by... never mind, we talked about that last hour. I hate to, as I said earlier, I hate to get into this this topic. I really do. I'm not comfortable in talking about what I'm going to bring up now. But I guess as long as we insist on sending boys into combat or war or invading other countries, this is going to happen. And by boys, I mean that. I'm not trying to be slick. I'm being definitive. A 19-year-old boy who is put through 6 weeks of basic training and then maybe another couple of months in specialized training and then given weaponry unparalleled in the history of the human race and turned loose in a foreign country, that is a recipe for murder, mayhem, rape, disaster, and a complete breakdown of anything that that we might consider to be civilized. I don't know that it's not for me to even debate because I'm not smart enough. But I don't know if the time will ever come when human beings can eliminate this bloodlust, this thing that we call war, organized conflict. I don't know. I really don't. Stories from the Washington Post: U.S. soldiers hatched a plan that was savage, to randomly target and kill Afghan civilians and to get away with it. Now, the Army has brought charges against several soldiers, members of a platoon from the 5th Striker Combat Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division. And according to the Army's documents, members of this platoon hatched their plan and then one day last winter launched it against a solitary Afghan man who was walking in a village in Afghanistan. One of the soldiers pretended they were under attack and he tossed a fragmentary grenade to the ground so they would have proof later on. And the others opened fire. According to the documents put together by the Army, the unprovoked fatal attack was the start of a months-long shooting spree against Afghan civilians that resulted in some of the grisliest allegations against American soldiers since we invaded that poor country, Afghanistan, 9 years ago. Members of this platoon have been charged with dismembering corpses, photographing them, taking their skulls, taking other human bones, fingers, hands, feet. Son of a bitch. I mean, now these are our people. And don't if you're a right winger, don't email me anything about, well, what about the Muslims that cut off people's heads? It all sucks. I'm talking about our people. I'm talking about the United States of, by God, America, the Christian nation, right? The investigation, since this information surfaced, has raised accusations about whether the military ignored warnings that these out-of-control soldiers were committing these atrocities. I mean, this kind of stuff, and keep in mind, just like the Abu Ghraib torture pictures, this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. When you have a country like the United States of, by God, America, a Christian nation that decides, well, we can invade anyone we want to hell with international law, we can torture, we can rendition people, we can do anything we want to do. Then this is one of the results. The father of one soldier said he repeatedly tried to alert the Army after his son told him about the first killing. The Army more or less told the father to go pound sand into one of his body orifices. They weren't interested. Then two more civilians were killed. Military documents now allege that five members of the unit staged a total of three murders in Kandahar province between last January and May. Seven other soldiers have been charged with crimes related to the case, including a retaliatory gang assault on a private who blew the whistle on these bastards. Army officials have not disclosed a motive for the killings, and this weird, macabre behavior, nor have they explained how the attacks could have persisted without attracting scrutiny. Oh, give me a goddamn break. What do you mean, how the attacks could have persisted without attracting scrutiny? From whom? These are boys. These are punks who are taught to kill anything, anybody, and then they're sent into a country that never did a thing to us and they're turned loose. What do you mean, scrutiny? Scrutiny. According to statements given to Army investigators, members of this unit, 3rd Platoon, Bravo Company, 2nd Battalion, 1st Infantry Regiment, began talking about forming a kill team in December. Shortly after the arrival of a new member, Staff Sergeant Calvin Gibbs, 25, of Billings, Montana. And before we judge Staff Sergeant Calvin Gibbs too harshly, remember the Supreme Allied Commander until he was cashiered, Stanley McChrystal, in Afghanistan, worked in special ops for a number of years at Dick Cheney's behest. Stanley McChrystal ran a murder squad. An assassination team, extrajudicial killing. And the targets were determined, one presumes, by Dick Cheney and the corporate thugs who controlled Dick Cheney. So before we judge this hapless staff sergeant, let's keep that in mind, which is not to excuse the staff sergeant. It's just to kind of put things in perspective. Remember how the right-wing media in this country, tried to minimize what happened to Abu Ghraib. Oh, what a Rush Limbaugh say. Oh, fraternity hazing. Sick bastard with his great big arse pimple who got out of the military. Oh, fraternity hazing, that's all that was. What would you call this, you slime ball? Gibbs was described
as...
Speakers, it'll be our secret.
Past the hour. This, a lot of folks have read this novel. A lot of you have read this on an allegorical level. The theme of this novel is the conflicting impulses towards civilization. On the one hand, live by the rules, live in peace, harmony, justice, you know. On the other hand, the will to power. Different subjects include the tension between groupthink, and individuality in this novel, between rational and emotional reactions, and between morality and immorality, and how these play out and how different people feel the influence of these conditions forms the major subtext of this novel. And it ties into, very directly as far as I'm concerned, the children that we are arming and training and turning loose in countries like Afghanistan or Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo. We strip these children of any ability to think rationally, because war and death and murder is irrational by definition, isn't it? You decide. In the midst of a World War II evacuation, a British plane crashes on an isolated island. The only survivors are all male children below age 13. Two boys, the fair-haired Ralph and an overweight, bespectacled boy reluctantly nicknamed Piggy, find a conch shell, which Ralph uses as a horn to assemble the other children. Two dominant boys emerge during the meeting. Ralph, who has the conch shell, and Jack Maradoo, a redhead who is the head of a choir group that was among the survivors. Ralph is voted chief, losing only the votes of Jack's fellow choir boys. Everybody else votes for Jack. Ralph asserts two goals: have fun and work toward rescue by maintaining a constant fire signal. So Ralph tries to bring a little bit of rationality into a situation that rapidly has become irrational for these kids. They build a fire using Piggy's glasses, and for a time the boys work together while they erect shelters. They gather food, water, and they keep the fire going. Now Jack, in the meantime, he is organizing his choir group into the group's hunters, who are responsible for hunting for meat and maintaining the fire. Ralph, Jack, and a black-haired boy named Simon soon become the supreme trio among the children. Piggy, the most sensible of the bunch, and you can argue most sensitive, is quickly outcast by his fellow biggins. They call them biggins, the older boys. The biggins. They're also littleins. And Piggy becomes an unwilling source of fun and teasing for the other children. Simon, the black-haired boy, in addition to supervising the project of constructing shelters, feels an instinctive need to protect the little ones, the younger boys. Now, the original attempt to impose order by Ralph quickly deteriorates as the majority of the boys turn lazy and idle. At one point, Jack summons all of his hunters to hunt down a wild pig, even the ones who were supposed to be maintaining the fire. During that hunt, a ship passes the island while the choir boys are in the bush. But with no one to maintain the smoke signal, the children are not discovered. And they all watch as the boat disappears. Although the chase of the pig turns out to be the group's first successful hunt, Ralph is infuriated that they missed a potential rescue. About the same time, many of the little ones begin to believe that the island is inhabited by a monster, referred to as the Beast. Ralph gets them all together to refute the Beast's existence, but the meeting turns riotous. Jack gains control of the discussion by boldly promising to kill the Beast. And later, Ralph thinks about relinquishing his position, but Piggy discourages him from doing so, while the two of them and Simon are desperate for some guidance from the adult world. But they're not going to get that guidance, are they? Because these boys are stranded, these little English schoolboys are stranded on an island. And the more you think about this, you think about these American boys, 5 or 6 years older than these boys, who are stranded In a civilization they don't understand and handed firepower, there is no civil authority, there is no legal authority. Oh yeah, they have a guidebook they're supposed to go by, but who's watching? More when we come back. They try to play a before the hour. So what we're talking about here is this story in the Washington Post over the weekend. It was on Saturday, so a lot of people missed it. U.S. soldiers, boys, I don't get the goddamn how tall they are or how many muscles they have. These are boys. These are 18, 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old males. These are boys. Their brains haven't even finished forming yet. And they are trained and armed, and they're trained to kill without question. And then they are armed with some of the most sophisticated weaponry ever put in the hands of human beings, and they're turned loose in countries that we have illegally invaded. And they know what the game is. They've been told what the game is. So some of them, quote, go rogue, end quote, and start killing civilians for sport and cutting off their heads, taking their skulls and their fingers and their toes. And the army's investigating. The army is all upset. Ooh, what's this? What it is, you morons, is what you trained these boys to do. So back to the comparison with what these boys have been doing in Afghanistan and the novel. A bunch of boys survive a plane crash on an island in the South Pacific in the middle of World War II, an evacuation trying to get the boys out of England. And first they try to organize, and it starts to fall apart. After twins Sam and Eric report possibly seeing the beast atop a mountain christened Castle Rock, Ralph and Jack investigate. Now, in this novel, Ralph is the good kid. Jack is his evil counterpart. They encounter the corpse in the open parachute of a fighter pilot who had landed on the island and died. And they mistake that as the beast asleep. They run down the mountain, and Jack assembles the children with the conch shell and confirms the beast's existence to them. Yes, there is a beast. The meeting results in a schism, splitting the children into two groups. Ralph's group focuses on preserving the signal fire. Jack becomes the chief of his now own tribe, which focuses on hunting, while he continues to exploit the ironclad belief in the beast. Only I can protect you from the beast, boys! Sound familiar? As Jack and the hunters have already slain their first pig, they offer promises of meat and fun and protection from the beast. Jack's tribe gradually becomes more animalistic, applying face paint to liberate their inner savages while they hunt. The face paint becomes a motif which recurs throughout the story with more and more intensity toward the end. Simon, a part of Ralph's tribe, who had cracked, nervous breakdown. Now remember, these kids are all under the age of 13. Simon cracks and goes off looking for the beast by himself. He finds the head of the hunter's dead pig on a stick, left as an offering to the beast. Simon envisions the pig head swarming with scavenging flies, as Simon calls it, the Lord of the Flies. and believes that it is talking to him. This lord of the flies talking to him, Simon. Simon hears the pig identifying itself as the real beast and disclosing the truth about itself, that the boys themselves created the beast and that the real beast was inside them all. Simon also locates the dead parachutist who had been mistaken for the beast and is the sole member of the group to recognize that it is a cadaver instead of a sleeping monster. Simon eventually arrives at the peak of a tribal ritual at Jack's tribe, a ritual in which Ralph's tribe is taking part as guests. Simon attempts to explain the truth about the beast. However, the other boys, still reeling in bloodlust from their most recent kill, blindly attack and murder Simon, whom they mistake for the beast itself. Ralph and Piggy later try to convince themselves that they didn't take part in the murder of their cohort. Jack's tribe then raid Ralph's camp to steal Piggy's glasses so they can make a fire. Ralph's tribe journeys to Jack's tribe at Castle Rock to try to get back Piggy's glasses. In the ensuing confrontation, Roger drops a rock on Piggy, killing him, and the conch is shattered. Sam and Eric are captured and tortured until they agree to join Jack's tribe. Ralph is forced to flee. The following morning, Jack leads his tribe on a manhunt for Ralph. During the pursuit, Jack's tribe sets the island foliage ablaze in an attempt to drive Ralph into the open. And the forest has until then been the only source of food and shelter for the boys. Stricken by terror and exhaustion, Ralph expects to be discovered and killed. However, the fire and smoke attracts the attention of a nearby warship, ironically, one filled with adults. A naval officer lands on the island near where Ralph is lying, waiting to be murdered. And the officer's sudden appearance brings the children's fighting to an abrupt halt. Upon learning of the boys' activities, the officer remarks that he would have expected better from British boys, initially believing that they were only playing a game. And in the final scene, although not certain that he will be rescued after all, Ralph breaks down and cries. And if you remember from your reading of that novel, Lord of the Flies, when the camera, that is your eyes, being manipulated by William Golding, the author, when the camera, your eyes, pulls back from the scene, what do you see? All of a sudden, instead of seeing two warring tribes, violence, death, murder, mayhem, slaughter, and laying on the sand, poor old Ralph, this kid, waiting to be murdered with sharp stakes, the same way the pig was slaughtered. He's laying on the sand, and as the camera, your eyes, pulls back, what do you see? You see a motorized landing craft approaching the island, and adults getting out, and all of a sudden, as you look at these boys who moments ago were involved in the most ritualistic and vicious of tribal warfare, all of a sudden, they're boys. They're just boys. They're just British school kids. Without the uniforms, with their hair mussed up and coloring, paint all over their faces. What does that remind you of? Camouflage paint. Only the boys on the island didn't use camouflage paint. They used bright colors that they got from the flowers and the berries and the fruits. When I read in the Washington Post online about these U.S. soldiers who reverted to savagery because there were no adults around to tell them not to. And in fact, what few adults had been around had told them, okay, there are rules of engagement, but your primary concern is to kill people and destroy things. Kill people and destroy things. But you have to kill people and destroy things within the framework of the rules of engagement. Our rules of engagement no longer incorporate any of the Geneva Convention decisions. The previous administration declared those all null and void, and the current administration doesn't seem to give a damn. As far as interrogation, you know full well, boys, that we torture. We torture ourselves, and we subcontract out the torture to people to whom we pay money or to people to whom are looking for political favors. Now, get out there, boys, into Afghanistan, and remember, rules of engagement. Rules of engagement. Rules that we have made up. Stay within the rules, boys, as you kill and destroy. And remember what we're all supposed to pretend we're doing. We are winning the hearts and the minds of the people of Afghanistan. Right? The hour. Well, that was certainly unnerving. You know, every time I read another investigative piece about atrocities committed by American soldiers, in my experience, it starts with me lie. I'm talking about our people, our tribe, Americans. I'm not talking about the Bataan Death March. I'm just talking about our people. Remember, we are told, our soldiers are told, our young boys are told when they are beat into soldiers, mentally beat into soldiers. They're told, we're the best. Everybody else is an inferior race. All the derogatory terms used for the people that we are going to go murder, whose countries we are going to invade, the complete brainwashing of a kid, a boy. And I don't care if you are listening to this program, you're 21 years old and you've had three tours of Iraq. I don't care. You are a boy. Your brain hasn't even finished developing yet. And look at it. Oh, never mind. You know what I'm saying. I'm not addressing the soldier. What the hell does the soldier know? He's taught to go kill and destroy things. Period. They can call it anything they want. Nation building. Oh, hog crap. Winning hearts and minds. Oh, give me a break. Come on. We know what war and invasion and occupation and death and destruction and murder and mayhem and rape and pillage is all about, don't we? Of course we do. Me Lai was the first eye-opener for me. What? because I grew up on all the World War II movies. John Wayne, who was so much of a coward, he did anything to avoid the draft himself. But I grew up on those movies. The Sands of Iwo Jima, Pork Chop Hill. I mean, on and on and on. And it's very clear to me, as a young white American male, what the story was. The story was we were number one, and we were being attacked from all sides by communists, gooks, slopes, Japs, dinks, Jerrys. All of them out to get us and kill us. So therefore, in the movies anyway, on those Saturday afternoon matinees, when I would sit there in the dark with all the other little 10, 11, 12-year-old American boys watching these movies, the message is very clear. Kill them. Kill them all. Let God sort them out. Because that's what we were about. And it was justifiable killing. We got to defend our moms and her baking prowess, you know, apple pie, and defend our Christian way of living. Oh, yeah, that's right. We have a few Jews over here. Well, anyway. And then me lie. And I saw those pictures. Now, I had read about what we did in the Spanish-American War, thanks to Mark Twain's writings. I knew about how American Marines practiced the new Gatling gun, a new invention, by rounding up Filipino villagers and putting them in the crater of an extinct volcano, and then lining the rim of the volcano with Gatling guns and opening fire. But that was, you know, that was a long time ago. That was 100 years ago. And then me lie. That wasn't 100 years ago. That was then. Now. So, when the Bush crime family declared that the Geneva Conventions were inoperative, they no longer meant anything, that our rules of engagement would be made up on the fly if necessary, and besides, who in the hell would be checking? Who would be keeping tabs on the boys? And some of these boys had the appearance of men, like George W. Bush, but were about as mature as any 19-year-old boy. About as mature as Ralph and Jack and Piggy and Simon. And they had their Lord of the Flies, too. And the Christian right in this country has its Lord of the Flies. And I just wonder sometimes how we deal with this. And I think the quick answer is we don't. We just avoid it. Doesn't happen. Oh, war is hell, we say. Well, the first casualty of war is truth. Well, you know, you've never been in combat. Don't talk about it. Well, you don't know what goes on. Well, it's a lot of stress and strain. Well, that's what war is all about. Which kind of is the point, precisely. So why do we couch it in terms of, our heroes? We are doing this for the greater glory of humankind. Ooh, we want the Afghans to be able to vote. What, just like the Iraqis, huh? I wonder when it's ever going to stop. I think the quick answer is never. Not until all of a sudden some adults show up, come ashore in a landing craft, and find us all standing around with faux war paint on our faces and sharp sticks in our hands. And then the naval officer will say, this is awful. I thought Americans were a little bit better than this. You think? I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.